Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today we're here with Aaron Stewart Malden, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of South Florida. She's co-editor of the Environmental History in the American South series for the University of Georgia Press, among her many other activities. But we're here today to talk about her book that came out in 2018, Unredeemed Land, An Environmental History of the Civil War and Emancipation in the Cotton South. Aaron, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Aaron, would you start by just describing your project to our listeners?
Yeah, sure. So this project is, as the title says, an environmental history of the Civil War and Emancipation, specifically in areas of the U.S. South that grew cotton in the late 19th century, which if anyone knows stereotypes of the U.S. South may seem like everywhere, but wasn't actually everywhere. It began as a dissertation at Georgetown University under John McNeil, and my starting point was wondering why no one had written anything about the environmental impacts of Reconstruction in the South. If you know anything about Southern history, there was a timber boom, there was a railroad boom, urbanization kicked up, you had the after effects of a four-year war on the landscape, and I wondered why nobody was writing about it. And so that's where I started.
Lots of people know a lot about the Civil War. And, you know, Reconstruction is playing a much larger role in our national memory now than it did probably when you started your project, and certainly more than it did 20 or 25 years ago. But I think that, you know, most people don't really have a very good sense of the environmental history of the Civil War period. I mean, there's certain stories we tell. The military story, of course, has been around for a long, long time. And increasingly, you know, the scholarship, or the, especially at the popular level, around the Civil War has revolved around the Black freedom struggle and the political issues around Reconstruction. So I feel like, you know, kind of walking us through this project would maybe really enlighten a lot of people about what an environmental history of the Civil War would add. So I guess to start with, your book starts out in the antebellum period. And can you talk about, you know, agricultural practices in the antebellum period and what this looked like in the 1840s and 50s?
Yeah, sure. So in the 1840s and 50s, you see the maturation of the sort of slave plantation complex that we all think of when we think of the slave South. There were several different areas of the U.S. South that relied on cash crops, cotton, rice, tobacco, sugar. But beyond that, most farmers lived and worked the land and ate what they grew. And perhaps they grew a little for market, but they raised livestock. Perhaps they had a slave or they relied on slave labor that was hired or rented. But most farmers sort of grew a mix of crops, primarily for subsistence and perhaps in some areas with market access to sell a little at market. Because of the specific sort of environmental conditions of the South, it's hot. It's humid during the summer. There's a really long growing season. If you've ever been driving on the interstate in the South during the summer, you know you're susceptible to gully washer thunderstorms that can blind you in a car, but can wash away your soil on a farm. And because of these sort of various environmental conditions, Southern farmers used different agricultural practices in general than Northern farmers. So Northern farmers would use one plot of land for long periods of time, perhaps multi-generational. They would raise livestock on pasture. They had dairy and butter, fruit orchards, things like that. But in the South, lots of farmers weren't able to do those things. The soil is more mediocre down here than it is in some areas of the Midwest or the U.S. North. And it erodes more quickly. It's less fertile without fertilizer. And before air-conditioned barns, cows couldn't handle the heat. So dairying wasn't a big industry in the Deep South. So Southern practices looked very different from other places around the U.S. at the time. And the reason why that's important for the environmental history of the Civil War, I argue, is that the Civil War disrupts Southern farming practices in a way that makes them less sustainable over time.
And how does this connect up to the sort of the political history of the antebellum South? You know, you have this, you know, this aggressive Southern expansionism, and, you know, that really, you know, hits a peak around the Mexican War and then expands into the 1850s. And so you have this happening at the same time. You have this kind of complex agricultural regime going on that perhaps is more complex than our usual general thought of a giant plantation of slaves growing cotton. That's, of course, a piece of the story, but it's not the whole story. So how does this connect up to this sort of antebellum history that our listeners might know?
Right. So, the planters and slave owners who were driving the political debate in the South over expansionism and, as some scholars have recently argued, sort of a slaveholder's empire across the Southwest and the Caribbean, they were concerned, yes, with keeping their property and in human beings, their incredible economic investment in this brutal institution. They were also concerned that part of what Southern agriculture looked like depended on being able to pick up and move when your soil was exhausted. They didn't have the livestock numbers and the cattle to be able to manure on most farms. The only commercial fertilizer available at the time was guano, which was made from the droppings of seabirds. And it was incredibly expensive and rare, and actually long-term harmful for the soil. So a lot of Southern farmers knew that once their soil ran out, they would either have to move to a different part of their farm, which most did, but eventually you run out of areas to farm, and lots of people just thought it was cheaper to pick up and move on. How can you pick up and move on if you've run out of fresh soil and new land? And so if you look at the debates, especially during the 1850s, during what we call the sectional crisis, when, you know, the threat of secession hung really heavily over most political debates, you see that, yes, slavery is number one issue here. I'm not saying that it isn't. But beyond that, there's a very real concern for the physical health of the land where they live, and the fact that they envision having to move on continuously to be able to maintain the profitability of their agricultural practices.
You know, to kind of build on this, you know, one of the sort of debates in the food world today is about sustainable agriculture. And, you know, there's a kind of sense that, you know, modern industrial agriculture is disastrous and we need to go back to these sort of pre-industrial sorts of ways. And while I don't think too many of the people who are sort of engaging in this debate are really thinking of the antebellum South as a kind of model, I mean, in terms of how we would talk about sustainability today, it seems to me that what you're saying is that, you know, yeah, these people practice this kind of complex set of farming, growing multiple crops and things like this, but it's not really sustainable at all. So, I mean, I guess, how would you evaluate the land use practices of these antebellum farmers?
Yeah. So there's actually a really big debate about this amongst Southern historians, particularly those interested in agriculture. Were Southern antebellum farmers soil miners, or did they perhaps have the conservation of their land as a priority? And I think it just depends on where you look and when you look and who you look at. Rich planters could afford to be more conservation minded because they had the slave labor to perform conservation tasks. They had the capital to invest in better machines or, you know, more complex plows. And they just had more to work with. Whereas you see poorer farmers picking up and moving on rather than conserving more often. And so there's this idea that slave owners were rapacious with their use of the land, just as rapacious as they were with their, you know, the acquisition of human property. And that's true to some extent. But also, there are a lot of instances where you see conservation practices like intercropping, where they use, you know, peas in amongst the corn to fix nitrogen into the soil. They do manure, they do terrace, they do use slave labor to fill gullies and burn trees over the soil to help regenerate soil nutrients and things like that. So on the whole, no. Antebellum Southern farmers were not sustainable in any social class. However, the difference between the antebellum period and the postbellum period, meaning the period after the Civil War, is huge. So if the antebellum period was a slow-moving disaster, right, the Civil War just put its foot on the gas, and what we see after the Civil War is much more harmful for the landscape as a whole.
So let's take it into the Civil War. Talk about this environmental history of the Civil War and why it becomes so transformative.
So to some extent, those who are interested in military history know that military history deals with the environment a lot. Weather, terrain, the use of animals in battles, that sort of thing. Food, disease, right? These are all things that both military and environmental historians are interested in. The difference is that environmental historians are bringing the insights of the natural or hard sciences to bear on questions that military historians have typically been asking for ages. So instead of just terrain, we're interested in geology. Instead of just weather, we're interested in long-term meteorological patterns, the Civil War drought. Instead of just disease, we're interested in sort of the epidemiology, and we document that. And I'm really into soil science and animal science, and because that's what I studied in grad school to some extent. And so I started with questions like, if you put 60,000 soldiers in a forest, what happens to the forest, right? These Civil War armies were living at levels of consumption that we associate with sort of societies that burn biomass for fuel, right? They don't have coal on the wagon behind them, right, to burn. They're cutting down trees to build tents, to make plank roads and encampments, to create defenses and defense works, to line trenches, to haul things. They're using wood basically for everything they're doing. So you put Sherman's army in a forest in North Georgia for weeks while they're laying siege to Atlanta, what happens to the forest, right? And so these are kind of questions that I'm interested in, not just for the disappearance of woodland in the South, the disappearance of animals, the spread of diseases, both to animals and people, shortage of subsistence. I'm not just interested in that. I'm interested in what that means after the war too. So if you're interested in the environmental history of the Civil War, there's a really big growth in that field. Since I would say 2000, 2010. So you have Lisa Brady, Megan Kate Nelson, Judkin Browning, and Tim Silver just released sort of a big synthesis of the environmental history of the Civil War that I recommend. And Ken Noe is putting out a new book on the weather in the Civil War. And so you have lots of these different subjects to choose from. And basically, the argument of all of these scholars, including me, is that the environment matters for the course and importance of the Civil War to those who lived through it. And that you can't understand the military outcomes of the Civil War, and even that big question of why the war, North won and why the South lost, without looking at these environmental aspects of the conflict.
So since your particular interest is in soil science, how does the study of soil science help us understand the Civil War and its aftermath in new ways?
So I'm particularly interested in the long-term effects of Civil War defense works on farmland. If you look through the amazing atlas that accompanies the official records of the War of the Rebellion, which is widely available online through a couple of different universities, you can see that the miles and miles of defense works, both those that were planned, like those around Richmond, and those that were thrown up as armies moved across the landscape and had to pitch works before a battle. They called it throwing up earth. I'm interested in how those defense works were often on private land or on commonly held farmland. And if you have men digging huge trenches through your field, how productive is it after the war? How long does it take that soil to regenerate and to get down to the nitty gritty, quite literally? How does mixing up of soil horizons affect the productivity of the soil or the kinds of nutrients available to crops? I went through several soil science classes at Georgetown at a graduate level and spent a long time thinking about pedoturbation, the way that soil mixes as you plow it or as it goes through sort of a traumatic event like the Battle of the Crater, right? That creates an entirely new soil that doesn't grow the same things the same way ever after, right? I'm also interested in how when you cut down old growth forests, right, you cut down hardwoods like maples and oaks and things like that in a southern forest, what grows back is pine. And pine not only doesn't produces less forage for animals who might graze there, both domesticated and wildlife, but also pine needles, when they drop, they make the topsoil more acidic. So if you cleared pine land to grow something on it, it's going to react a different way to your crops than if you cleared maples or oaks. So these microscopic changes that Civil War armies made over and over and over again do, I think, have a significant impact on what Southern farmers were able to grow and how well they were able to grow it on that land many years later.
So let's to take the story then into Reconstruction. You know, what is this environmental history of Reconstruction? How does, you know, these impacts of the Civil War help shape, you know, the Cotton Kingdom that develops after 1865?
So I think we could divide the environmental history of Reconstruction, into three different areas. Number one, you have the ecological legacies of the physical damage of the Civil War. And that is much more pronounced in places like Virginia or Georgia or anywhere where you had long-term operations between both armies. And in Virginia specifically, they camped over the winter for 4 years, and that makes a big difference. So you have physical damage from the war. Number two is you have emancipation. And emancipation is a huge part of the story, not just for how we understand sort of the political aims of Reconstruction, but also if you think about it in sort of non-US terms, what emancipation does, it creates a new class of essentially landless peasants, right? Lots of people have done work on comparing serf emancipation in Russia to slave emancipation in the U.S. So you have, 4 million future farmers who have been set free with no promise of land or, well, no actualized promise of land, no capital, right, and significant barriers to the acquisition of capital or land. So that's number two. And then number three, you have sort of the redirection of the Southern economy after a pause, right, of recovery. Beginning in 1870, you have these Southern planters who are seeing fewer and fewer profits from their land, and obviously their investment in humans has been wiped out. They're looking to make a buck somewhere else. So they ally with Northern banks and Northern investors. And you see this sort of nascent industrial boom that begins in the 1870s across the South and lasts well through, the 1970s. And so you have mining kick up. in ways that it hadn't before. You have entirely new cities, you know, sort of materialize. Birmingham, Alabama springs to mind, founded 1871 at the center of several different mining camps. You have the expansion of railroads. You have clear cutting of forests, right? So you have this sort of industrialization that occurs. So those three aspects sort of come together to form what I would consider the environmental history of the Reconstruction period. And all of that relates back to how people were thinking about Reconstruction laws, how they were thinking about North-South relations, and how they were thinking about making a living.
So how long does it take for these farmers to realize that their, you know, sort of soil regime that they had engaged in before the war, their farming regime, was just simply not going to work in the new environment of post-Civil War South?
It takes some longer than others, but I would say about 5 to 10 years. What changes first is not really any recognition of physical change, although you see descriptions of, you know, quote, titanic furrows run through, you know, one's cornfield, right, by soldiers. You see those in letters all the time. But what really changes is the way that labor is organized on the land and what's possible as far as farming. So during the antebellum period, shifting cultivation and letting fields that perhaps were less fertile lie fallow while you move and you clear new ground, that was a really key practice. When you divide up your land to several tenant farmers who are each given a plot, a 1-3 mule plot, to work until they leave or you kick them off. You can't move or clear new ground, so you have to buy fertilizer. And by the 1870s and 1880s, sort of advances in agricultural science and the discovery of phosphate mines in Florida and South Carolina made sure that there was sort of a fertilizer boom that accompanied sort of the upheaval of emancipation. And so what you see is the transformation of farming practices that initially solve some problems, right? If you have no access to land, or if you have no access to a plow or a mule to work that land, then sharecropping seems ideal, right? You get to keep a share of your crop for the work that you do. And depending on how much the landowner puts into the arrangement, that sort of determines the landowner's share of your crop at the end of the year. So that seems like a really great compromise. But what happens is that all of these environmental changes, these ecological legacies of the changes made by the war and emancipation, sort of bite farmers in the behind. They create new natural limits on cultivation that force farmers to go further and further into debt for less and less return from the land. And so you have this really predatory system, both from a racial standpoint, with landowners taking advantage of landless Black farmers, but also from an environmental standpoint.
And so let's bring, you know, cotton into the story then. You know, so how does it end up then that, you know, you have cotton really being much more dominant in the South after the Civil War than before, but of course, you know, at the levels of poverty then also being much, much higher than it had been, at least among the white population before the war?
Yeah, so when you start a research project like this, you have lots of questions, right, that you want to answer. And one question for me was, why did so many people grow cotton who hadn't before in environments that it wasn't suited for? Specifically at a time when food insecurity and destruction of property from the war was so high, right? If you're starving, why wouldn't you grow food instead of cotton, right? And so it's sort of a very simplified research question there. So I wondered why, if cotton was growing as a regional crop during the antebellum period, but it wasn't until after the war that it really took hold and made sort of a solid South based on cotton cultivation. Why was that? And why was it making people so poor as you said. And during the writing of this book, I sort of decided that people used cotton as a secure way of selling a crop. It was the one crop that would pay. And it was sort of used as a currency in a cash-poor society. But cotton demands certain nutrients from the soil, and it demands a specific type of care, and it demands a certain environment. And people all over the South, in places that were vastly ill-suited for cotton, were trying to grow it. And so you have a lot of outlay for this finicky crop, and you don't have a whole lot of return. And so the natural limits on cotton cultivation, combined with environmental damage over preceding decades, sort of created this limit on what you could do with it. The southern environment just required too many inputs, and it created sort of this cycle of debt and poverty for a lot of farmers.
So what, you know, with you see the sort of revival of Reconstruction studies and, you know, a whole lot more scholarship on it, and particularly focused on the failures of the political failures of Reconstruction, does the environmental history of Reconstruction help us understand the political failures of Reconstruction in a different way?
I think so. I think that people often forget that emancipated slaves were living on the land, and that the land itself tells a story and changes over time. Without access to capital, without guaranteed access to lands and the ability to farm and make a living, the environmental limits on cultivation also limited economic independence of freed slaves. They were starting a race not only handicapped by racial prejudice, but lots of other sort of economic and environmental limits. And so I think by adding environment to the story, you see the failures of Reconstruction to create economic opportunities sort of play out in real time to real people. And you look at, you know, sharecropping contracts change over time. You look at tenants' account books from general stores and things like that. And you can see the slow sort of decline into permanent debt that they weren't able to get out of. And so I think it highlights the fact that while Reconstruction did a lot to create a legal basis for the civil rights of many different groups of people, in the nation, it didn't go far enough as far as creating opportunities for economic independence to go with the legal freedom.
One last question, and I know historians hate counterfactuals, and I'm certainly one of them, but, you know, in the conclusion of your book, you do kind of touch on it in terms of thinking about, you know, what would the South have looked like from an environmental perspective had it not seceded, right? And so if you want to speculate, since you sort of do a little bit in the conclusion, are there differences, do you think, fundamentally between what the South looked like in 1900 in real life versus what it might have looked like otherwise?
So I think I agree. I hate counterfactuals. But you do sort of have to wonder, right? Because there is such a difference between pre and post-war systems of agriculture and the way that you think about what you grow and how you grow it. And I think had the South not seceded, there things still would have come to a head either over abolition or land expansion, or both. It just may not have happened as soon. And I think you still would have had the creation of an agricultural system further west that was even more fragile than the more fertile soils back east. And so perhaps instead of dealing with massive soil erosion, you would be dealing with a system based on cotton production affected by the salinization of soil from long-term irrigation, right? So I don't think that Southern farmers' mentality would have allowed for sustainability on any level in any environment. But I think that secession and the Civil War accelerated the environmental damage that was already being done.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Again, I've been speaking to Erin Stewart Malden, and she's at the University of South Florida, about her book, Unredeemed Land, An Environmental History of Civil War and Emancipation in the Cotton South, published by Oxford University Press in 2018. Erin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.